ran against the grain. Are children inherently creative? What might be seen as a given is actually a relatively new notion, and as Amy Ogata argues, it took hold in the United States under particular circumstances, driven in part by Cold War anxieties about the health of the nation, along with a desire by toy manufacturers to sell products to unlock children's creative process. I'm Sasha Lilly, the art historian, will discuss the preoccupation with nurturing childhood creativity, which remains with us to this day. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The decades following World War II were marked by seeming unbridled optimism and Cold War disquiet. One place where this contradictory anxiety and optimism came together was in childhood, how it was viewed and shaped. Particularly, there was a focus on the idea of fostering childhood creativity to keep American children ahead in the race between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And the means were through mass consumption items that supposedly stimulated the inner creativity of children. As Amy Ogata has written, these concerns shaped schools, playgrounds, the layout of the home, and myriad consumption items directed at children, such as playhouses and toys. She's professor and chair of art history at the University of Southern California, and in Designing the Creative Child, Playthings and Places in Mid-Century America, Ogata situates today's assumptions about childhood creativity that may erroneously appear timeless back to their historical origins. Let me begin by asking you, Amy, about this prevailing assumption about children's inherent creativity. Where does it come from, in fact?
Well, I think that the idea that children are creative, that they are naturally creative, is something that has gained a lot of speed in the 20th century. It's something that is very much apparent in the child-rearing literature, in the study of children that develops really forcefully in the years in the 1920s and the 1930s, but then it becomes something that is widely disseminated in the years after World War II. So the idea that children are creative, that they might make these interesting discoveries, is something that psychologists, but also artists, were really interested in the teens and the 20s. But become something manufactured, sold, and then widely studied in the 1950s and 1960s in particular.
Well, I realize it's a hard one to nail down, but how should we even define creativity? What does that mean?
This is such a hard word, and the critic Brendan Gill has called it a word as light and wayward and almost as untetherable as milk down. And I think that is exactly right, because it's a word that we find very difficult to actually define. It is something that becomes immediately very tautological. It means creativity means the ability to create. And so we're left without very substantial ways of defining it, but it becomes associated strongly with ideas of innovation, with ideas of ingenuity, of new insight, and all of these kind of associations of discovery that get packed into the idea of creativity. It also has connotations of authenticity, that there's something that is inherently pure or unique that it lives in this concept of creativity.
Well, you just said that the idea of children as innately creative really flourished in the 20th century. And I wondered if you could break that down a bit and talk about first the changes in academic views about child development in the early 20th century, moving away from some more rigid notions around education and the capacities of children. What shifted and how did it shift?
In the early 20th century, there are some really interesting educational models, and particularly designs for schools that are accompanying specific programs, curricular programs. And these are pioneering efforts. They are the kinds of things that are not mainstream at all. They are very much, you know, a kind of conversation between an educator or school district and a designer. And so the idea that children are creative, that this is something that can be enhanced through education, it becomes palpable in the early 20th century, and particularly among émigrés from Europe. So this idea of studying children, looking at their artwork, thinking about how they think, some of their insights, are ideas that become interesting to designers and to educators, and they begin to develop specific kinds of schools, specific kinds of learning environments, specific kinds of art education programs to foster these insights, right? To instead of mainstream the idea of, you know, being a good citizen, but rather to look for some of these more exceptional talents that they see as really interesting and promising. And again, this is something that is very small scale in the early 20th century, but becomes something that is much more widespread after World War II. And it happens gradually over time, but there are some very high-profile examples. In the United States in particular, there are a couple of really important models that become highly publicized. So one example would be the Crow Island School that was built in Winnetka, Illinois. It's in the Chicago suburbs, between 1939 and 1940, so just before World War II. And it's this collaboration, this really complicated and interesting collaboration between a specific kind of educational outlook and educational ideal that is designed really in concert with the local school district and the architects. And the architects are Eliel Saarinen, who's a Finnish émigré, comes to the United States in the 20s and 30s. And this project becomes something that really flourishes as a result of this very unique collaboration that happens between a set of educational ideals, but also then some very willing and interesting designers.
Well, in thinking about how children are viewed in society, obviously there are all sorts of anxieties and differences to do with class and race that get also projected onto children. One of the things that I found very interesting in your book is shifting views from the late 19th century through the early 20th century about early childhood education with different classes of children in mind. So the kindergarten, the notion of the kindergarten, right, which comes from Europe, being focused on poorer children, and then the emergence of the idea of the nursery school amongst progressive looking educators, nursery school, of course, preceding kindergarten, for a different class of children. How did that develop, and what were the origins of the concerns around these two schools, which again sort of come down to us as something almost natural, that children might go to a preschool, that they would go to kindergarten, and these would be beneficial for them?
Absolutely. This the kindergarten model is one that's developed in Europe, in Germany, in the late 1830s and 1840s. And when it comes to the U.S. in the late 19th century, it is implemented as a way of helping poor families, as a way of teaching children who might not have some of these advantages, as a way of instilling certain kinds of habits and a kind of knowledge. So it's very different from the way it's theorized in the 19th century. And kindergarten, of course, we now understand as a very standardized, you know, step in the educational process, and particularly in the United States. But it was something that was introduced at the end of the 19th century. The preschool, the idea of nursery school in particular, is something that in the 20s and 30s was very rare and very much the province of an elite, progressive person or family who was interested in particular scientific views of what we would call the child study movement. So they were fairly rare. And the idea that preschool is something normal, which we now live with, is something that really develops strongly in these years just after World War II. And one of the reasons for this is the shifts that are taking place in labor during wartime, when there are new possibilities for preschool for working mothers, for example, who might be going off to factory jobs. Some of these programs continue on. Many of them do not at all. And they get reinvented in new ways. There's a whole literature, interesting literature, on collaborative child rearing preschools that people built in their own homes, in their own neighborhoods, where people are creating kind of co-ops of watch your children, you watch mine, but let's do something with them during this time. And that's something that happens very ad hoc in the 40s and early 50s. The idea of preschool as something normal, as something expected, develops in part because of the tremendous influx of new births. So the book is very much about the baby boom, which was this massive rise in live births that happened in the United States between 1946 and 1964, and resulted in nearly 80 million new children who came on the scene very quickly. So 4 million a year, every year, between 1954 and 1964 alone. So the pressure that all of these new children are putting on the institutions that exist are really exacerbating some of these kind of growing trends that are developing gradually but become very immediate concerns in these years after World War II.
Right, and you argue, Amy Ogata, in your book, Designing the Creative Child, Playthings and Places in Mid-Century America, that these social changes that followed World War II especially really shaped ideas which in many ways have come to us as seeming natural, and you're really placing them in their historical situation. And of course, that situation was, as you just mentioned, one of enormous increase in the number of children being born following World War II. It was also a period, especially for white middle-class families, of increasing affluence. And it was a period which, in some contradictory way, was simultaneously a period of great optimism, but also anxieties. Can you expand on that contradictory aspect of this period?
Yes, this is a period in which there is this tremendous optimism after the end of the war. And part of that is, we understand that historically as this rise, this demographic rise in the number of new children born. But what's also obviously a moment of tremendous anxiety about geopolitics and about this phenomenon that we call the Cold War. And the kind of sense of potential catastrophe that might at any moment befall this nation newly, you know, emerged from wartime anxieties. So there's this lingering cloud of war, and this is kind of compounded by this sense of fear that is very much part of the experience of the Cold War. And so while when we look back, I think, at these post-war years, it's very easy to see them as a kind of really innocent moment, as this moment of tremendous economic growth, of the rise of real wages. But it's also a moment that is very much self-critical, and it's also a moment that is very much defined by some of these larger external political concerns that are weighing very heavily on everyday people. It's also a moment of tremendous growing strife in terms of race and class, and this is the part of the post-war era that we tend not to focus on. I think there's been much more scholarship on it in the last 10 years, but it is something that the kind of rosy view of the post-war era in the U.S. Is really dogged and shadowed by the internal politics in the U.S., but also this external force that is wielding tremendous pressure.
And also, of course, war, even if it doesn't take place on the soil of the country, it certainly didn't take place on U.S. soil.
Right.
But yeah. War does upend all sorts of traditional hierarchies, including gender roles. Was there some way that in the post-war period, shifts that may have happened during the war then were reflected in visions of the family, visions of childhood, visions of motherhood?
There is a very interesting conversation, particularly among experts, and by experts I mean pediatricians, doctors, psychologists who become vocal and whose views are repeated constantly in popular magazines. And there's this perception that the structure of the family itself is something that should be thought of as an important dimension of the larger politics of the era. And the Yale psychologist Arnold Gazelle suggests that a totalitarian model of family life, where there's a strong father who is the powerful figure in the family structure, the family unit, is a dangerous one. And so argues strongly that the family should be something more democratic, that democracy begins in the household, and that children should be part of this entity in a way, giving them new power, a new kind of agency in the family unit itself. And I think we see this in the ways in which the house is redesigned in the years after World War II. This is obviously a moment of tremendous building efforts on the part of merchant builders who are creating these vast tracts of suburbia. It's also a time when there are some very high-profile architects who are building model houses. And one of the features is the playroom. And so this kind of new emphasis on giving children their own space in the household is something that becomes a kind of new norm. It was something that was certainly available to elite children in the 19th century, the early 20th century. But it's something that becomes a kind of staple of this child-centered life, particularly in suburbia. This is the ways in which suburbia is sold to young families, that it's better for the children. They would have a place to play both outside in these suburban environments, but also inside in their own playroom. And so there are various museums, the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis, the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, that stage these model houses in which the playroom is a kind of a new space that gains tremendous attention. People are certainly interested in the ways that the kitchen is arranged. They're interested in the ways in which the social spaces are presented. But there is a kind of fixation on the play areas and the ways in which they're related to these other spaces in the house. And I think that tells us something about the power of children, the perceived power and needs that children have within the family unit.
That is the voice of art historian Amy Ogata. We're speaking about her book, Designing the Creative Child, Playthings and Places in Mid-Century America. That book is published by the University of Minnesota Press. And you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. So we're going to talk a whole lot more in the course of this hour about the many ways that this post-war emphasis on childhood creativity emerged, took form in the built environment of houses, in schools, in playgrounds, and the toys that children were encouraged to have to be bought. But before we delve deeper into that, I want to ask you about just this general notion of childhood creativity. It sounds like what you're describing is a shift toward what may be termed a kind of more humanist view of children, that this could be considered maybe a progressive move in terms of understanding children, moving away from some of the rigid patriarchal notions of the past.
But do you actually see there's something wrong with this basic premise about the innate creativity of children that is embedded in all of these ideas?
I think that this is precisely the problem that I was trying to explore in the book, was to think about the ways in which we assume so much about children and their growth, their development, their insights. And it's particularly this dynamic between the adult and the child, right? So this idea that the child is innately creative, and there are many psychological researchers who are fascinated with this notion, and they begin to study it in a very intense way after about 1950. And it is started off by the new president of the American Psychological Association, J.P. Guilford, who is inaugurated in 1950. And his inaugural address is precisely about creativity and the ways in which it hasn't yet been studied, hasn't yet been given its due. This initiates this tremendous onslaught of interest in children's creativity and the idea that children were naturally creative and that they lost this creativity over time as they went through the process of maturation, through the schooling process, that they became uncreative, that they suddenly became adults who no longer had access to these insights, to this originality, to this authenticity. And all of these questions are lingering ones in the 50s and 60s, because this is precisely a moment of tremendous anxiety and tremendous self-questioning about the conformity of American society. So the idea that children are naturally creative was something very much assumed, but it was also put to a test in several instances. There are a whole battery of tests that are developed to measure creativity. One of the most important one was developed by E. Paul Torrance in the early 1960s, and it's still a test that's given today to test, to ask children to examine problems in fluency, to test originality, to look at their verbal and nonverbal activities, to think about both divergent and convergent thinking. Some of these ideas, this attempt to quantify creativity on the part of researchers in the post-war era is something that has not stopped in the course of the 20th and 21st centuries. But there's also a tremendously interesting amount of research about the idea of creativity and its relationship to giftedness. There are researchers who are thinking about what is this relationship? You know, are smarter, you know, those who have more aptitude in taking tests naturally creative or not creative? And so, again, this is all part of an attempt to try to harness creativity, to figure out what it is, and to think about how it can be perpetuated into adulthood.
When one thinks of creativity, the kinds of images that come to mind often are of the sort of more bohemian end of the spectrum, the creative artist and so on. And yet, in the post-war period, which was a period of enormous economic growth, the sort of golden age of American capitalism, would you say that creativity in some way may have dovetailed also with the notion of the entrepreneur? When you were talking about how do we even define creativity, you mentioned innovation. Obviously, that's a prime value for entrepreneurialism and capitalism.
Yes and no. I think that that's something that has become more closely associated with creativity in the 21st century. I think in the post-war period, there is a lot of interest in thinking about new ideas. The idea of originality, even in itself, is something that is given much more attention in the era of just after World War II. Yes, it is a moment of tremendous growth, and there are these major corporations that are very much invested in the idea of creativity in the 50s and 60s that are beginning to think about personality and the ways in which they can make use of some of these more idiosyncratic people that they might want to have working for them. So there is a tremendous focus on adult creativity that is parallel to what is happening in the study of children. But I do think that that's something that has become more of a focus in our own time, in the late 1990s, around the turn of the century, and then certainly it hasn't stopped in our own present moment.
Well, you were just mentioning the companies that benefited and used some of the emerging ideas around psychology, also in terms of their own marketing. One statistic that you mention in your book, which was very striking about this period, was that between 1945 and 1950, consumer spending rose 60% in the U.S., and spending on household items increased a whopping 240%. Now, obviously, this is coming out of the more limited consumption of the war years, but still, those are enormous increases. How did that intersect with these theories about objects and environments helping children's development and the development of their creativity?
There are certainly more available dollars to spend, and there is a growing perception that children have needs, and that we recognize this by giving them things of their own size, their own furniture, their own, you know, certain kind of spoons and plates and bowls and things like that. And so there is a growth in real wages, for sure. There is a tremendous amount of spending that is lavished on children that is indicative of a kind of reassessment after the war years. And you're right that it is in contrast to these much leaner years that this seems to just mushroom in this way. There is also the growth of these kinds of businesses that are pitching to parents that their children should have certain kinds of toys, that we might think about needing new kinds of garments, something like this plastic diaper cover that is invented in 1950 and is something that is tremendously popular. Now, obviously, children were wearing diapers for many years before the post-war era, but suddenly the idea that you need things for your children becomes something that is taken up very widely and really is a force in the American economy. And the manufacturers of objects for children, and probably the most prominent of these manufacturers are the toy manufacturers, are very keen to tell parents that they should be providing their children with a certain kind of stimulation, and that they should be buying toys, not just at holidays, which had traditionally been the great moments of consumption around toys, but to tell them that they needed to provide these things to their children year-round if they wanted them to become, you know, well-adjusted, good citizens who were being stimulated in these appropriate and correct ways. So the toy manufacturers are very sad about the availability of parents, you know, the parents' willingness to spend on their children, and they begin to pitch their objects to specific ages, really dividing up the toys that are appropriate for children at certain ages, and also educational toys, you know, not these kinds of novelties that might be really popular around the holidays, but this kind of investment in the household, the investment in the child that the educational toy represents.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of Designing the Creative Child, Playthings and Places in Mid-Century America. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press, and its author is Amy Ogata. She is professor and chair of art history at the University of Southern California. We're talking about the push for childhood creativity in the post-war period, ideas which seem to be still very deeply with us. I wonder if you could talk about some of the iconic toys of the era we're talking about following World War II and how they were supposed to encourage creativity in children?
Well, probably the most iconic toys of the post-war era are not part of this discourse. So toys like the hula hoop, toys like Barbie, are probably the ones that most listeners would associate with this moment. But there is a whole genre of toys that developed in this moment, in tandem with this conversation about promoting creativity in children, that some of which, you know, still exist today. The House of Cards, which was designed by Charles and Ray Eames in 1952 and came originally in three different sizes, is one of these objects that had flourished on the market and then was reintroduced, and it's still available today by a different manufacturer. But it was part of this genre of toys that were designed by artists and architects, professional designers, rather than these big toy manufacturers, that stands for a kind of openness in the design of playthings. So the House of Cards is a series of kind of cardboard, stiff cardboard rectangles with rounded corners that have six slots. And you can reposition these cards in various ways, in a kind of modular way. And you can build them, you can expand these structures that can be assembled with this object in a whole variety of ways. And this is an object that is very much typical in the sense that it doesn't have instructions. Or if there are instructions, they are really just a starting point. There was a toy that was developed by the Walker Art Center called Magnet Master. It was very short-lived. It was really an immediate post-war project. It was a project that was created by an architect named Arthur Carrara, along with Daniel Deffenbacher, who was at the time the director of the Walker Art Museum. And he also was an architect, and they're very much interested in the ways in which design as an activity, an open activity, a creative activity, is something that was a kind of natural way to garner children's interest and to seize upon objects as a way of enhancing some of these instincts that they saw as very natural. And so they developed this toy called Magnet Master that was a series of metal plates that could be put together with L-nickel magnets. So this is a kind of very strong magnet that holds these plates in place. And they create this set, and they market it as a new creative toy, as something that has no instructions, because children are naturally creative and they will naturally create their own interesting objects from this kit of parts. And so the kinds of toys that I discuss in the book are really kits. They are the kinds of toys that don't have instructions or models to build, but really emphasize the child's agency in thinking about how they want to use these materials. There are other toys by designers, a set of flexagons, as they were called, that were designed by a Seattle architect, Fred Bassetti. And these are simple little cardboard cutouts, again, that could be assembled with a series of rubber bands. And the idea is using these kinds of ordinary materials, things like, you know, magnets or cardboard, to allow children to develop their own playthings, in a sense. One of the reference for these kinds of open toys is the cardboard box. And this is a toy that, of course, is certainly not one that's necessarily manufactured for children. It's a kind of ready-made, all right. But it's one that is always referred to as, well, if you don't have the money to build a playhouse, just get your kids a cardboard box. Or using cardboard, using these kinds of disposable materials that allow children to impose their own will upon the materials and upon these kinds of forms.
Well, you just mentioned the playhouse, and that is one concept, I guess, that took different forms that was important in this post-war emphasis on childhood creativity. whether it was a playhouse inside or a house in the backyard for children. Why playhouses? What sort of significance did they have in terms of allowing children to have a particular kind of creative play?
The playhouse is an object that certainly predates the post-war era, and it is one that was available to elite families. So there's these tremendous little miniature houses that were built on elite estates in the late 19th century and early 20th century. What happens to them is that they become consumable by middle-class families in the era after World War II. And instead of having working kitchens where children are allowed to, you know, bake their own bread and make their own soup, which was the case in these very lavish examples before the war, the examples that develop after World War II are really open, again, like some of these toys. They are often a simple draping of a card table or a cardboard box or these easy to assemble temporary spaces that can be set up both indoors and outdoors. And the idea, of course, of the house as giving children their own space is something that is very much tied to this fixation on housing in the post-war era. And this is obviously a moment when there's a huge conversation that is happening around giving children their own space in suburbia, of families wanting to have their own space. And for the first time, they are able to buy a house of their own. And so this is really extended to children in the family. Children themselves are given their own little miniature houses. But really distinguishes them is that they are for pretend, right? That by giving children a playhouse, part of the idea is to give them a space that's separate from the adult world in which they can invent their own games, their own characters, their own fantasies in this space. And it's so the blankness, I think, of the post-war playhouse is one that is encouraged as a way of stimulating their creativity, as a way of suggesting to them that play on their own, apart from adults. But again, this is something that is manufactured and assembled and offered to children by adults, is the expectation that they are going to have this very vivid interior life in these miniature domestic spaces.
My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm speaking with Amy Ogata, art historian and author of Designing the Creative Child. What about the design of schools? You've mentioned the design of houses, how creative living was shaped in the post-war era, and notions about children's toys and environments domestically. How did these ideas around expanding, nurturing children's creativity take place in the classroom?
But this is a huge subject that really preoccupied Americans at the end of World War II and throughout the post-war era because of the surge of new children and some of the population shifts that had taken place. So entire suburban tracts that are developed. There is a tremendous need for new schools. That is something that is very, very pressing. And there's a kind of panic about the fact that they haven't been building schools during the Depression, haven't been maintaining schools, and that educational ideals have also changed since this era. So there's this a kind of convergence of the pressure of all of these new children looking for seats in classrooms and not enough classrooms or classrooms that are perceived as outdated. And so there is this resurgence in the attention to education and particularly to elementary and high school education that becomes something that is discussed very widely. It's discussed among professional educators. It's discussed among architects and urban planners. It is also very prominent in popular magazines like Life and Collier's and Ladies' Home Journal that again, taking up an idea that is pervasive in this moment. And the pressure on schools is only heightened after the launch of two Soviet satellites, Sputnik 1 and 2, in 1957. And the American government passes the National Defense Education Act in 1958. And this allows for a dramatic influx of federal funding into education. It allows for federal funds for school building. It allows for the development of new programs in science and foreign languages, and is very much a response to these Cold War pressures that are being felt in the realm of education. And there is a concerted effort to build new schools. So not only is there this pressure to find seats for children, there's a pressure to rethink the school plant itself, to ask, what do we need in this new era? And it is perceived as an era in which there is tremendous change and new values that are being put on educating children in particular. And this is very much in dialogue with the idea of progressivism and progressive education in particular. And this is kind of a moment of critique as well. There is historians of education really debate this question of how influential progressive education was. And the consensus is that it was an idea that had very lingering effects, that in practice it was not implemented necessarily in the ways that some of the great theorists of progressive education would have perhaps wanted to see. But one point that I make is that for architects and for designers, the ideas around progressivism are absolutely resurgent in the ways that they are rethinking the school itself. So they're interested in some of these technical questions around how do we light our schools? How do we increase airflow? How do we think about making an optimal environment for children to learn in? But they're also asking these really interesting questions around how do we instill some of these individual values? How do we make democracy understood in the classroom itself? How do we encourage children's creativity? So the pressures to not just build a whole bunch of schools, lots of classrooms all at once, but also to really rethink, what is this curriculum doing? How are children responding? And what are the ways in which the physical, material aspects of the school can enhance some of these experiences and these lessons?
So how did these ideas about reshaping schools extend to other environments, such as the playground?
Yes. So the ways in which the school plant changes is that it becomes largely one story, open to the outdoors, open to areas for children to play. And so the playground is a kind of immediate, really adjacent figure, space in this larger question. But because cities are undergoing tremendous change at this moment, there are many new playgrounds that are being planned, not just for school plants and campuses, but really for communities. And they are rethinking what it is, what are these spaces, and trying to shift some of the conversation around how children play to into different kinds of registers. So the idea of the playground is one from the late 19th century, from the progressive era. And it develops in a kind of standardized ways in which there are swing sets, there are jungle gyms to climb on, there might be a seesaw. And many of these are just repeated over and over and over again. Again, you know, really standardized equipment. And there is a move in the early 50s to reconsider the playground, to ask it to do different things for children, to let children take the lead instead of lining up and waiting for turns on the swings. These are playgrounds that are designed to give everybody an opportunity to play simultaneously, to think about making their own spaces, using these aspects that can be reconfigured by children, so allowing them to be the designers of their own environment to a certain extent. There was a high-profile exhibition and competition for new playground equipment that was sponsored by the toy manufacturer Creative Playthings, and it was co-sponsored with the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, and it gave three designs high prominence, and these were designs that allowed children to exercise their bodies, to have hiding places. They were designs that were easy to manufacture, that could be repeated in various configurations, but they were very much designed in contrast to the idea of a conventional swing set or jungle gym. They were looking much more towards sculpture and to some of the ideas that were being conceived in Europe, and particularly by Scandinavian designers who were thinking about play structures as sculptural elements. And so there's a concerted effort to, again, incorporate architects, designers, and artists into the conversation about what the playground is, who is using it, and how it looks in relationship to the built environment that is changing really substantially in this period after World War II. The playground becomes a site of regeneration, and it becomes a site of liberation. But it's liberation not just of physical energy, but it also becomes a place where aesthetic lessons can also take hold. And so thinking about the way the playground looks, the design of it, the aesthetics of it, the ways in which it encourages a child's agency and creativity were all parts of the ways in which the playground was rethought in the period after World War II. And it's really the era of the mid-50s to the very early 1970s.
The Children's Museum also came into its own in the post-war era, driven by concerns about nurturing childhood creativity. How did the kinds of children's museums that were shaped at that time set out to cultivate the creativity of American children after World War II?
The Children's Museum is an invention of the turn of the century, from 1900. And one of the first children's museums is the Brooklyn Children's Museum, which was devised as a place for children to have after-school programs, to engage in nature study. And so the Children's Museum is an established type before the war, but it becomes something much more popular. And even existing museums are redesigning their children's quarters as a way of engaging new visitors. So major art museums like the Metropolitan Museum of Art or the Art Institute of Chicago are giving new attention to areas specifically for children and devising exhibits and libraries and galleries that are specifically for children. There are also children's museums, new museums that are being built that are specifically for children themselves. This is an explosion of children's museums that happens after World War II. And they become places for children to explore. And the Brooklyn Children's Museum is a great example because it is renovated dramatically, in fact, rebuilt in the late 1960s. And the plan is completely different from the structure that existed before then. And it is devised with different areas for children to explore, for children to find things of their own interest, to play with machines, to figure out how windmills work, to mix soils in a planting station, to figure out how to refine grain that is milled, and to explore quite sophisticated questions around waves, ripple tanks, these kinds of ideas that are being explored in secondary science classrooms as well. So some of these ideas around science that are being rethought in the post-war era are available in children's museums as well as in kind of high school science curriculums.
I wanted to end by asking you, why you think it is that these ideas about the innate yet cultivatable creativity of children have become so standard today. You talk about the context in which these ideas took shape following World War II. The times we live in now are quite different with different sets of concerns. So why is it that these notions about childhood creativity and the importance of fostering it are so absolutely standard? Is it because they're right? Is it because there are a different set of anxieties, but they fit in with those post-war ones? Is it that those ideas were just so immensely powerful that they've shaped everything that came after it?
I think that they were tremendously powerful. And I think that this kind of ready consumption of creativity through, you know, the purchasing of special kinds of toys, toys that were understood as open-ended, that allowed a child to participate in the playing process, were something that has proved commodifiable, right? So there is a huge market for children's goods today, just as there was in the late 50s and early 60s. And many of these same discourses are extremely familiar, and they are repackaged in a sense. So you could go into any of these big box stores and see aisles of what are called creativity toys. And they are all kinds of objects. They tend not to be these kinds of arty designer toys. They tend to be things like crayons and kits. And so there is certainly a rhetoric of creativity that I think we tend to see in very limited terms, but we still very much associate with children. We see the idea that children can manipulate objects in ways that are unconventional and maybe unanticipated. And so certainly manufacturers have been very savvy about using that rhetoric to promote the things that they sell, even if they are things like taking a sticker off of, you know, one page and putting it on another page. The promise of enhancing creativity is something that is everywhere in goods for children, but certainly, as you suggest, it's also very much in our world for adults as well. And so the idea of creativity as something that is going to save us, that's going to save our economy, that is going to allow us to compete in a global environment, these are all the sometimes unsaid and sometimes quite obviously stated promises that creativity seems to offer to us. I think we are in a moment of tremendous anxiety about our place in the world. It's a different kind of geopolitical question than the one that faced people in the 50s and 60s and 70s, but it is still very much a part of the world that we live in. And it is something that has become naturalized in business in particular. And so the idea that creativity is the thing that's going to help your business, that's going to make money, that's going to be the new idea, that's going to be the sensation, it's going to be the thing that is going to save the country, is a refrain that is not uncommon in our own era.
I've been speaking with the author of Designing the Creative Child, Playthings and Places in Mid-Century America. That's published by the University of Minnesota Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Amy Ogata is professor and chair of art history at the University of Southern California. Her other books include Swedish Wooden Toys. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.